Bell stopped. I guess it was bound to happen someday. And then last Sunday morning, while we were giving the talk, and when I left, I discovered on the radio that that was the morning the bomb started. And it was very poignant for me to leave here realizing that during our talk and our sitting, that's what had gone on. And it reminded me of a quote that I read some years ago. It's an anonymous quote, and it says, "We live in a world torn between wanting to listen to the sound of a flower growing and wanting to ignore the sound of the sky falling. But sometimes being sensitive enough to the first process, we acquire the energy necessary to prevent the second." And the over and over again you find in Buddhism the emphasis is do we begin with ourselves, and the focus on finding peace is we begin where we can do the most difference, where we can make the most peace, as we begin with ourselves. And we don't sacrifice our own peace, we don't sacrifice our own inner welfare in order to rush after trying to prevent the sky from falling elsewhere. It isn't that we don't go out and try to prevent the sky from falling, but we try to do it in the spirit of peace that is possible to discover through practice or through other ways. So you might not be satisfied with this emphasis of Buddhism, but Buddhism, the strength of Buddhism is in offering a practice and teachings that helps us really understand ourselves really well. And the encouragement that you start with yourself, you start finding where the inner conflict is within yourself and how to overcome that inner conflict so you can be at peace. And it can seem at times that that's a pretty trite thing to do, pretty insignificant, sometimes even selfish to do that when the world has tremendous needs, the world around you. And it's very common in America in the 25, 30 years I've been involved in Buddhism for someone to come, and I haven't had this difficulty myself directly, but someone who's doing meditation practice, and a relative will come to them and say, "You're so selfish, you're so self-indulgent to be involved in this meditation practice. And you should be out doing something for the world." Now, if the same person, instead of doing meditation practice, had done stamp collecting, the relatives probably wouldn't have complained. But there's something about the nature of Buddhism or practice or religion where the expectation is that that domain, that aspect of our being should be engaged in, you know, externally in service and helping and altruistic activity. And that part of our being is inappropriate to be turning it in towards ourselves and clarify ourselves. In the teachings of the Buddha, one of the causes of war that he said is people who are obsessing with their thoughts and views and opinions and ideas about how things are. And that one of the ways to end war is to help people, help ourselves no longer obsess about views and opinions and ideas. Now, obsessing is a very difficult thing to stop, as many of you can learn when you try to sit down and be still. And the training of meditation is a training not only to find ourselves to be at peace, but also a very honest training that helps us look at our mind, to really see what's going on in our own mind, take stock of our own mind, become familiar with our own mind, so that we can start, if we can't find peace in our own mind, at least we can have enough familiarity with our own mind so that we don't cause any further harm. There's a beautiful story I tell sometimes during the introductory course that there was a king or queen, we have told it here, queen in ancient times, very ancient times, And she was out in her queendom one day, and she stubbed her toe because she was walking on barefoot, as everyone did back then. And she said, called together her ministers and said, "This does not, shouldn't be. And please carpet the kingdom, the queendom, in with leather." And then a wise minister comes up to her and says, "There's a better way. And instead of carpeting the whole kingdom with leather, we just carpet the soles of everyone's feet." And that was the invention of shoes. And to somehow know how to know where the point of contact is with life and know how to protect ourselves or take care of that place is a much wiser strategy than trying to provide security and, well, you know, and the whole world, make the whole world safe and secure is quite difficult, maybe impossible. But to take care of the place where we contact the world and make sure that's a place where we're protected and where we offer our protection to the world by not offering further harm from ourselves. So to focus, you know, so the point of Buddhist practice is that point of contact and to understand the nature of that place. So part of mindfulness practice is to help, is a training to help us return to that point of origin, the point where everything arises out of, the original beginning, not, you know, some cosmological or mythological beginning, but the beginning in our own immediate experience, where things begin with our contact with the world around us. If you encounter another being, another person, or if you don't encounter another person, and the other person's your enemy, it's easy to demonize them. It's easy to have all kinds of ideas of what kind of person that is and how horrible they are. And then when you actually encounter that person and find out a little bit about their lives and their children or all kinds of things, suddenly you might still not accept some of the things they're doing, but you start having a very different understanding of that person by having direct contact with them. When we don't have the direct contact, what we're left with is our proliferation of ideas and thoughts and opinions to go by. And so to find ways to be in contact with others, to find ways to make the contact closer and closer to it so it's more and more immediate. So we can't, you know, have contact so easily with the Taliban who are far away, but can we narrow the distance so that we can see them more clearly for what they are? And can we offer ourselves so that we close the distance so they can see who we are in a closer way? The mindfulness practice is a practice of trying to find that place of contact, the place of meeting, and coming back to that. And as we sit in meditation, you'll see that how quickly the mind spins off into thoughts and ideas and fantasy and future and past, and gets caught up by its emotions and feelings. And it very quickly leaves the place of contact. You might start that way, at a place of contact. You might be sitting here, and it feels very quiet and peaceful. And suddenly, some sound occurs outside. Sometimes we're here, we hear the horseback ring next door. And you hear the loudspeaker go off, and that loudspeaker reminds you of loudspeakers maybe you've heard, I heard when I was in Southeast Asia. And the loudspeakers I've heard sometimes coming from military bases. And then I start thinking about war. You know, loudspeakers often mean war and you know, rallying the troops together and military parades. And I wonder, you know, how the war is doing, and I wonder how it's spilling off out of the borders of Afghanistan now and what's going on in Pakistan. And if Pakistan has the bomb and if Pakistan implodes, then what's going to happen with India? And if India and Pakistan go to war, then, you know, and it all started by having this very simple thing happening next door. And the origin was a contact. There may be a real concern that your mind went to follow the train of, but the beginning was that point of contact. You hear the sound. And how do you, if you really can stay there and notice the point of contact, do you really want to follow the train of thought? Is that train of thought being fueled by fear? Is fear operating? So the point of mindfulness is to try to notice that point of contact, notice the emotions that help spin us out, notice the process of spinning out, and try to have some control over that process so we can not spin out, we can stay in the point of contact. And that's phenomenally useful. You can encounter someone directly, you can have immediate connection with someone. And even seeing someone and talking to someone, your mind can spin out. And you're talking to someone else. You're not really talking to that person. The amount of projection that goes on in human society between each other is, of course, quite well known and is quite strong. To find out that the other person is different than what you thought is often quite humbling, sometimes quite inspiring. There is a... So the focus on Buddhism is to try to understand yourself and try to find how to be at peace with yourself. There is a... So a person who a person has always been running. A person was born running. Is always running. And a person is born barefoot, so running and running. After a while, the feet get kind of blistery and hurt. So having some shoes would be a good idea. So the person starts looking for shoes, looking for the right shoes that would help protect the feet. And the person comes comes across someone who offers them their shoes. I have extra shoes. You can have my shoes. But those shoes are too small. And so they get even more blisters and it hurts. And then the person goes along, takes those off, and keeps running, looking for others. And the whole purpose of running now becomes looking for other shoes. The shoes that are really going to help them run in a comfortable way. And they find shoes are too big and they trip over their own feet and they fall on their face. And so they keep looking for other shoes and running, and those shoes are too hard, too soft, too thin, those shoes are falling apart, those shoes are too this and that. And they're always looking for the right shoe, and occasionally they find the right shoe, but they're such a habit of always looking that they're not satisfied just having one pair of the right shoe because they're so afraid they might lose it. So the fear generates, I'll keep running, I keep looking for more and more shoes. And they're always looking for shoes. And the fact that they're running through beautiful countryside and in springtime and wildflowers, they hardly notice that because they're so concerned about the shoes. And then finally, they get really angry at this tendency to always be looking for other people's shoes to fit themselves. Forget that. I'm going to go back to my natural self and just go back to just being barefoot. And then I just stand on my own feet and just feel the contact with the ground and just be myself. And so they keep running, but they keep running and running. Now they're the self, and feet get cut up a little bit more. And it never occurred to the person that they could stop running. It's possible to stop running. And this kind of analogy, little story, describes many of our own minds. The tendency of our minds is to always be running for many people. Running, 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 looking for ideas, for concepts, for things that it wants. Looking for security, looking for pleasure, looking for status, looking for identification, reassurance, all kinds of things that we want. And the mind kind of looks for it and wants it and wants and wants. And sometimes you're successful in getting what you want, but what you want is not very stable. So things change after a while, and so then you have to want something more. If you're lucky, you get to get what you want. Maybe you don't get what you want. Well, finally, you get something that's not quite what you want. It's too big or too small, like the shoes. And so the mind is never quite satisfied, so it wants something else and wants something else. And so the mind is often quite busy chasing after ideas and thoughts and desires and plans or chasing after better pasts. You've done that? Forgiveness is the definition of forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So the mind runs and runs and runs, and even when it's successful and gets what it wants, the mind has no idea that it's possible to stop running. And part of what mindfulness is training us to do, is teaching us to do, or pointing towards, is it's possible to stop running with the mind. In order to do that, it's necessary to understand the mind really well. And so 90% of what mindfulness practice is about is not becoming calm or peaceful, but is about understanding those forces that keep us from being peaceful and calm. To understand those forces of running and grasping in the mind, in the heart, and what goes on. So, some of the things that propel the mind into proliferation of thoughts and ideas and keeps it running and is desire and wanting this and wanting that. And without coming to grips and really understand deeply the process of wanting, there is no going to be no peace. Another thing that keeps the mind kind of grasping outside of itself is aversion, running away, chasing, not wanting something and pushing something away. Some people have much stronger tendencies toward desire, and some people's predispositions is towards aversion. It doesn't matter what it is, but what's important is that you pay attention to what it is, what your tendency is, and then to notice what causes you to spin out? What causes you to leave the present moment? This study can be done very well in meditation because your distractions are reduced to a minimum, supposedly. And so you can be present for the moment of contact. You may establish yourself with the breath as the point of contact. And then you try to notice how can you stay with the breath, and what takes you away from the breath? What causes you to lean forward? What causes you to kind of spin out in the mind? And what you'll find, especially the quieter the mind gets, is a desire and aversion have a tremendous grip on the mind. And without then really, really coming to terms with it, really seeing it and being very, very honest about it, and learning how not to be caught by the desire or the aversion, you're not going to be able to stay at a place of peace. And you're not going to be able to stay in a place where you can connect with the world directly. Because part of the tendency of desire and aversion is it spins the mind out. And you're not really connecting with the mind anymore, with people as they actually are. So I'll tell you this story, partly because people enjoyed it so much Thursday. I was still hoping that you'll appreciate it, I guess, as much. this idea of projection and how much projection goes on and how we don't often connect with people as they actually are and how quick the mind can spin out that way. I sat 3 months in silence once on a 3-month retreat, and I fell in love with this woman who was sitting near me. And I didn't know her for anybody, but the mind can easily fall in love or fall in hate. Right then it was falling in love. And I don't like to get into relationships very fast. I usually kind of get into romantic relationships. So it was quite fine to be in a retreat because you can get involved kind of slowly over 3 months. And you couldn't talk to the person. You weren't even supposed to make eye contact, so it's really slow, right? And so, first started, talking and hanging out. And then this is a very nice person. And then it got involved, We maybe go out on a date a few times, and then we go on a vacation together, and what would it be like? And we do, 3 months is quite a long time to slowly let it build. And so then, after a while, it was going, getting engaged. And then it was getting married and having children. And it was a wonderful fantasy, I wasn't obsessed by it every moment of the retreat, but it would creep in here and there, and the fantasy would develop. And then that moment, the day that we broke silence during the retreat, we broke it by people being able to ask questions in the hall or something like that. And so I heard her in the hall, kind of sitting behind me, and she asked something. And it was the first time I heard her voice. And she had this very thick French accent. And just then, like this bubble popped, and I realized the whole fantasy of this person who I'd married was based on an image of her being an American. And I had projected all this Americana on this woman. And she wasn't that. And, I had lived in a whole fantasy about who this person was. And, it popped like that. So there's an example where the mind spun out from itself based on desire and wanting. Sometimes it spins out because of fear. fear, desire, aversion, restlessness, doubt, anxiety, are all forces that tend to, centrifugal forces that kind of make the mind spin out from itself, away from the point of contact and where our life begins. So to come back in meditation, come back to ourselves, come back to the breathing, and explore both the process of spinning out, but also explore what helps us to settle back more deeply in ourselves, what helps us become more at peace with ourselves. And I found that it's very helpful to breathe mindfully. Just the breathing itself tends to help bring calm. Not always. But one of the things I found is that it's very helpful to pay attention to what it feels like to be breathing. Not just to breathe mindfully, but to feel what it like to breathe within your torso and your body. And to notice the different aspects of your breath. To be discerning about what the breath feels like and how what it feels like at different times. And there are times when you might feel constricted in parts of your breathing. You might feel constricted in your chest, or you might feel it in your belly, or different parts of your body. And often the way we breathe, and the way we hold our posture, reflects something that's going on in the mind, some reactivity of the mind. Desire's there. Maybe there's kind of a little leaning forward. It might be a very, very small leaning forward, but if you stay very attentive in meditation, discerning and being with your breath, you might notice that the breath is a little bit held around the diaphragm because that's what pulls you forward slightly. And so if you feel that part of your breath, that holding, then and let go of it or relax or breathe into it if you can, then there's two things are possible. One is that little reactivity that's being in that part of the body is not going to be a fuel for helping you to spin out into all your other concerns. The other possibility is you can relax that. And to relax, you know, a little millimeter of your diaphragm and settle back on yourself makes it a lot easier than to be at peace, to be at ease, or to find that, to go towards that. And part of the process of being mindful is to begin becoming familiar with all these different places in the body where there's a kind of holding. And can you find a place to breathe? Can you find a place to sit, a way to sit, where you feel, where you can let go, or at least take into account the places of reactivity of holding within it. So I found the breath is very, very helpful in this process. And different times of day, different times of my life, different situations, different parts of my breathing will be tight or constricted or being held. And it's very helpful to begin breathing into that. And a well-relaxed breath is one of the best lubricants we have for our daily life. It really helps a lot. If the breath is lubricated, the breath is fluid, it's very hard for the mind to be fixed because of the close connection between the mind and the breath. If the mind starts getting fixated on something, notice what happens to your breathing. And the more subtle and more quiet you can get in meditation, the more you'll see the subtlety of how this works. If you're not aware of this kind of subtlety, at least you can be aware of it in the big, gross explosions of your life when you're filled with anger at something that's going on. This process of investigating the breath and what's where the breath is held and the relationship between our thoughts and reactions and the breathing is a very useful laboratory for understanding the forces of peace and the forces of violence within ourselves, the forces of conflict within ourselves. And so we investigate that. And how do we investigate conflict within ourselves? We try to do it in a non-conflicted way. We try to do it without further judging ourselves for being this way. So I remember a few weeks ago someone complained about being at a Buddhist group and feeling it was not okay to have un-Buddhist thoughts. And your meditation is a time where it's completely fine to have un-Buddhist thoughts. You know, the last thing you want to do is carry around some kind of standard that it's not okay to be how you are during meditation. Meditation is a time where you give yourself complete, radical permission to be as you are. And then to begin exploring it. Begin feeling it. You don't have to judge it, but you begin kind of exploring and getting to know it and becoming more familiar with it. What does it take for us to become peaceful ourselves? What does it take for us to stop the centrifugal force outwards? If we can't do it for ourselves, If we can't find how to be at peace in ourselves, don't know what it takes in ourselves, how much sense does it make to be asking and demanding this of other people? If we don't have a clue what the path is ourselves, then to criticize other people outside of ourselves for not being peaceful, what do we expect them to do? How do you expect them to find it if we don't have a clue how to do it for ourselves? If we can do it for ourselves, then maybe we can offer that to other people as an example. Or at least we can live a life which is harmless. It doesn't preclude being involved in trying to prevent the sky from falling. And it's not like either or situation. The hope is that if you can work on your own inner peace, that then you take that with you into whatever kind of social action or whatever activity in the world you feel is important to do. But for Buddhists, the beginning point is to find it in oneself and to do this practice. And to sit every day, to have a practice every day that helps you really confront the forces of obsessing and reactivity and the centrifugal force that carries us away from ourselves. I'm quite humbled. I've done this for many, many years now. And I'm still quite humbled by the power of my own mind and how house cleaning my own mind is something which is an ongoing process. And if we don't house clean the mind, it gets really messy in there. And the house cleaning of the mind, is to sit every day and learn how to settle back at a peaceful place. A couple of more words. One of the reasons to come back to the place of contact where it all begins, one of the reasons to become peaceful and calm, is not because of the value of peace and calm in and of itself, but from that place of being in direct connection with where the beginning of things arises, or be somewhat calm and peaceful, it provides a vantage point for us to understand the intentions that we base our life on, the choices we make, what motivates us, both in the big picture of what we do with our lives kind of motivation, and the little motivations about, how we talk to people and what we say, or where we go shopping, or what kind of activities we do in our daily life. There's a lot of motivations that are part of our life. Motivations and intentions are everywhere in our lives. Many of them are unconscious. Part of the value of getting quiet and peaceful in meditation is we can look at our intentions very carefully. And if our intentions are fueled by greed or by hate, then we want to look at that very carefully. And chances are, if you are very mindful, you realize what a tremendously negative cost it is for you personally, to be motivated by greed or hate. It's just simply not worth it if you really knew the consequences in your own psyche for acting on that way. Or you might notice that some of your motivations are based on generosity or love or compassion or wisdom. And noticing that, you might see, oh, this is really useful for me and for others. And you might be able to then differentiate between those activities which are fueled by wholesome intentions and those which are fueled by unwholesome intentions. And then you can choose which one you do. You can choose the intentions you follow. And this is a really, really important key part of Buddhist spirituality, beginning to choose which intentions you act on. So it's not simply just kind of a passive state of peace that we've come to, and then we go about our life, merrily, whatever. We use this kind of whatever peace and calm you can find as a foundation from which to look carefully at your intentions and then live in an intended way, intentionally, with our life around us, with wisdom and generosity and in ways that are helpful for ourselves and others. So then I'll end with this beautiful quote, story. A Native American grandmother was talking to her grandson about how she felt. She said, "I feel as if I have two wolves fighting in my heart. One wolf is vengeful, angry, violent. The other wolf is loving, compassionate, loving and compassionate. The grandson asked her, which wolf will win the fight in your heart? The grandmother answered, the one I feed. So use your practice to find your own peace, and use your practice to feed the right wolf, because the wolf you feed is the one that's going to win. So those are my thoughts for today. And so now it's your turn for questions or comments or reflections, objections. Yes. Can you speak a little louder, please?
I was thinking of the loudspeaker.
Yes.
And some way of trying to disturb my way of concentrating. It was interesting to hear that now, to really use that.
Yeah, great. I don't have a single, you know, answer, like one policy or something, but... One of the ways mindfulness is taught is that there are no distractions for mindfulness. So if your mind, if it isn't that the loudspeaker is causing you to react, it's your mind which is causing you to, is latching onto that in some way and then spinning out because of that. So rather than thinking of the loudspeaker as a distraction, if you take it as this is the point of contact where the meditation can occur, then you let go of the breath. And you're just there listening to that sound, and then because you're there listening to it, you can more likely notice how you might want to be might spin out, and then you can stop that process of spinning out. But you then do listening meditation. It's quite it's not a conflict with the meditation. It becomes part of the meditation. If what happens is if we try to stay with the breath, then really what's going on is we're caught by that sound, then you're likely not to notice. All the ways in which you begin reacting to that sound, and off you, and pretty soon, you know, you're in Afghanistan. Yes. Sure. Makes sense. So those of you who have been here, are here for the first time, every Sunday that we've been here for the last 3 years or so, at 9:45 and 10 o'clock, the church next door rings their bells. And so we're quite familiar and, you know, expect it. You know, we need to measure our meditation. You know, it's half over now. And now it's over. And some of us might feel comforted by that. It's very nice, that sound. And some of us, you know, have other associations, perhaps. And so it's natural to kind of, if it's comforting or very nice or pleasant, to miss it. And the mind goes off a little bit. And but so the point of contact is to notice. You know, you notice the bell's missing. The mind gets involved with that. And so then, and how far do you let your mind spin out? You know, pretty soon you might be writing letters to the Portola Valley Town Center and the local mayor. You know, maybe the mayor can do something about those bells, and you've lost yourself. When I was sitting here, at some point I noticed that there didn't seem to be any bells usual time, and it didn't occur to me that they weren't happening. I thought that You know, sometimes time seems really odd when you meditate. And I thought, well, maybe meditation's going really slow today. It doesn't seem like the other symptoms of time going slow are present. But maybe, you know, you never quite know. And maybe it's going really slow here. And so it was fine. And then I continued a little longer and no sounds. Well, maybe it's going really, really slow. And then I got a little bit impatient. And there was a little impatient, little kind of wiggling of impatience in there and concern, oh, you know, if it's if if it's only been 10 minutes and it's taken this long to get to 10 minutes, can I get through a whole half hour? You know, and it was just a small little, you know, little, you know, but I was there. I saw it and noticed that. And because I noticed it, it had no power over me. It had no effect on me. And I just went back to my sitting, you know. But if it would have been quite easy not to have noticed it so well and spun out by all those thoughts of irritation and impatience for why it's not there or whatever. And it wasn't until Stephen rang the bell that I understood what had happened. There were no church bells. No, I wasn't compelled to peek. Because I think that if I hadn't been present to see the little movements of impatience, maybe if that had built, you know, in the unconscious parts of the mind, I might have wanted to peek. But I was right there for it. Yes?
Yeah, just in terms of spinning out, we have so much anxiety. Spinning out, so prevalent.
And our fear, in that fear, sometimes has usefulness. Our fear is much more useful if we can keep it at the primary level before it's spun out into proliferating associated thinking.
I was in a hotel this week at a conference, and I saw CNN for the first time. I usually only do NPR negative. Mm-hmm. Like four messages in a row, the same four messages continuously.
So part of a wise life is to know what the consequences are for ourselves and different stimuli. So if you find that something stimulating you, and for whatever reason your mind is spinning out more and more and more and getting more and more anxious, then you decide, is this useful? And if it is useful, then stay with it. But if it's not useful, then maybe it's time to push the button, turn it off. Or take a break and go away and calm down. And then there are times when we really need to face something important in our lives. But sometimes we get overwhelmed, and sometimes it's useful to back off and get quiet and balanced, and then go back and face the issue when we're more balanced. Well, maybe that's enough for today. I have a tremendous appreciation for the power of mindfulness and the power of meditation. And in giving this talk today, it was really kind of an effort to share that appreciation with all of you and hopefully encourage all of us, including myself, that in this difficult time, it's maybe even more important for us to not spin out, but to find some way to connect to what's most deeply true in our own hearts. So may all of you be happy and peaceful, and may all of you know how to wisely respond to the sky that's falling. Thank you.